Good evening and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights or the arts in conversation. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And I'm joined tonight by the writer Rose Shapiro. Rose has written for newspapers, magazines and medical journals, including The Independent, The Observer, Time Out, Good Housekeeping and The Health Service Journal. And her book, Suckers, How Alternative Medicine Makes Fools of Us All, was published by Harvest Secker. That's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Thanks for coming on, Rose.
I'm pleased to be here.
So when did you, let's talk about first of all, when did the whole world of alternative medicine first become apparent to you?
Well, it's sort of a gradual process, I think. I, as you said, when you're reading out the list of things I've done in the past, I've worked for women's magazines where I think probably was the first published example of all that happening. And I was writing straight up and down orthodox health reporting, health feature stuff. And I could see that what they actually wanted wasn't that. They wanted, people were wanting more and more of the alternative-y kind of stuff, and I became more interested in it at that point.
To what extent is there a sort of case that it's easier to write about that? You know, the science journalism, it's something that's often criticised.
Well, you can say whatever you like, that's for sure. If you're writing about alternative medicine, and you can use lots of buzzwords that are kind of, in this particular instance, women's magazine-y words like balance and that kind of thing. So it's very appealing in that way.
Okay, before we actually start looking at perhaps some examples, just tell us what you actually mean by alternative medicine. I mean,
well, there's a cheap answer, which is if it worked, it wouldn't be alternative, but people don't really like that. And I also, there's another kind of tricksy answer, which is there isn't actually such a thing as alternative medicine. There's only medicine that works or medicine that doesn't work. I think the things, well, not I think, but in terms of evidence, the whole range of things that are thought to be alternative medicine come under the doesn't work banner.
Okay, well, let's have a look, first of all, before we do look at some examples in some sort of debt. I've got some ailment. It might be imagined, it might not. I'm going to go to Boots or something to look for a thing. Or in fact, before that, I'm going to research it on the internet and see what I can come up with and see which way I should go. So you talk about in one of the chapters how to spot a quack,
yes,
some of the obvious signs,
yes,
that you can see that come up again and again. So let's perhaps talk about some,
yes,
of those.
Yes, it's funny that, really, because they come up again and again to the point where I can hardly believe it, that it's coming up again and again. A very good example of that is the fact that they almost always say they have an 80% success rate. Whatever it is, 80% to find this or that. Sometimes some people say 99%, but it's mostly around 80 or so.
But 99% is obviously unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Well, very, very arrogant practitioners will say 99%. But 80% is a good figure because you see it and you think that really will work, but they're not claiming it works for everybody, but it's very likely to work for me. And sometimes I watch little clips on the internet of people selling their whatever it is, their treatments, and it gets to the point where they're saying, "We have found that, in fact, 80% of my clients," and there it is again. That's a good example. The other one is the universal diagnosis, which is closely allied to the universal treatment. So you come with your ailment, and I tell you that you've got something, some complaint like, you've got systemic candida through your body that's causing this imbalance, which is resulting in whatever your symptom is. Or there are a whole range of things that I can say, but I will stick with this one particular one that is the one I can treat. There's another, I'm talking in cliches now, but there's this other thing that one can say is that the orthodox practitioner treats what you have. The alternative practitioner says you have what she treats. So that's how it always works out. And then they'll probably, once I've diagnosed your candida and told you all about your symptoms that are the ones that you have got and say they are to do with that, I'll give you some sort of treatment that you'll pay me for, which is the same treatment I give to everybody. So that's the universal treatment. So that's another one.
What about the we're still on the, I'm still looking at the website.
Yes.
How is it going to describe
ancient
evidence?
Wisdom.
Oh, yes.
Ancient wisdom is really, really important.
Thousands of years,
yes,
old, obviously.
used by ancient tribes, used by the ancient Chinese, used by anybody 3,000 years ago. I'm not sure what... It's strange, that, because I'm not really sure quite what it communicates, but it makes people feel that it's tried and tested in some sort of way, not... I don't know why, but anyway, the interesting thing about that, of course, is that most of these things are not 3,000 years old. Not, you know, traditional Chinese medicine isn't 3,000 years old. The one that we see today on our high streets is a latter-day recreation, a rag bag of the old therapies put together
We'll talk about that. That's China. One particular thing I do want to talk about in a bit of detail, because I think that's a really interesting story.
Feeling worse is a sign of getting better. That's a very good one. Because what happens is that you come to me with your symptoms, I give you all a spiel, I take your money, and I give you whatever it is I give you, and you may get worse because it's going to get worse, or the stuff I've given you is in some way toxic and makes you feel bad. So you come and tell me that, and I say, that's a marvellous sign. That shows it's all really working out for you, and it's all the... toxins coming out or whatever.
I just want to go back quickly to the ancient wisdom thing before we start talking about the Chinese one, because there's a great, I can't remember who it was who said it, but there's a really great quote which is just brilliant, and we need to talk about this, from somebody talking about the idea that cancer, and for instance, there aren't that many examples of cancers in, as he calls them, primitive tribes, you know, non-Western organizations, which sounds quite reasonable, but this is probably very true.
Yes, except it's because cancer is a disease of old age and they don't live enough long enough to get it. I mean, clearly cancer is also, it is linked to aspects of the Western lifestyle, and I'm not pretending that it isn't, but this set, I mean, those particular people who say that about cancer not existing, they say that in fact nobody would die if we could live without the toxins of the Western lifestyle. And it's just, it's ludicrous.
Presumably Alzheimer's, for instance, as well. There's not a great deal,
of
that in Papua New Guinea or something. All right, let's go back to Chinese herbal medicine then, because I said it's a really interesting story. Everybody knows this. Everybody, you know, he just has the money in the street, he will know that the great thing about Chinese herbal medicine is that this is a system that's worked for thousands and thousands of years, but interestingly, as you've just hinted at, this isn't strictly the case.
Well, there have been herbal medicines in all cultures all over the world for hundreds and thousands of years. Probably they're probably the first kinds of medicines we ever came across, and obviously a lot of medicines that we use that are used in orthodox medicine are derived from plants. So, you know, I don't have an issue about plants at all. But the thing about the Chinese thing, which is very, very interesting, is that in China itself, all of these things, just like they were in Europe, were really, I wouldn't say going out of fashion, but they were supplanted by modern Western medicine gradually. And people who could afford it in pre-revolutionary China were turning towards Western medicine. But once, after the Chinese Revolution, there were, I think, something like only 20,000 Western-trained doctors for the whole of China, and it was necessary to have some sort of healthcare system in place. And it does seem as if it was a political decision to go back to bits, I mean, a mix and match of all sorts of different bits from various parts of China, and bring them all together and call them traditional Chinese medicine, and say that the barefoot doctors are now China's doctors. And then suddenly there was no doctor shortage. Everything was solved. And they also used the barefoot doctors to promote things like improved sanitation, and also, I think, some vaccination programs and things later on. But the bits and pieces that it all was... In fact, interestingly, now in China, are increasingly less used. If people in China can afford to use scientific medicine, orthodox medicine, that's what they go for. If they can't, they have to use Chinese medicine.
And let's talk a little bit about acupuncture as well, because there's this something that's featured in some, famously in some documentaries recently in the UK. This idea of the acupuncture as anaesthetic, you know, people having operations, and even this is something you describe as being a sort of propaganda.
Yes,
tool,
I mean,
really.
Well, the acupuncture anaesthesia is really, you know, it's the money shot when it comes to a film about acupuncture. And it's very beguiling. And this idea, it took off, I think we first heard about it in the early 70s when an American journalist had some acupuncture after he had appendicitis when he was in Beijing. But what it turns out with that, I mean, this happens again and again with alternative medicine. As soon as you start exploring it, you find another story. What you find with this one is that actually when people have acupuncture while they're having surgery, they are having a whole cocktail of drugs. They're having sedatives, they're having local anaesthesia, they're having whatever it takes to make it actually not unusual or surprising that they can undergo an operation whilst conscious. Or semi-conscious because of the sedation. And it also seems there are suspicions. You may remember, I think in, say, the 60s and 70s, there'd be trips from the West going around China to look at all these marvellous acupuncture, anaesthesia, surgical procedures. And I had some quote about somebody having some operation on his neck and then afterwards holding the little red book up and saying, welcome American doctors, long live Chairman Mao. You know, but they probably either were faked or were done with other agents like other kinds of anaesthetics.
There's a scene that you describe of people, I don't know why I laugh then, it's absolutely horrific, shouting out party slogans during
yes.
the operation as if, you know, clearly they were enduring
yes,
incredible
that's
pain,
right.
but
and
almost
I,
in
yeah.
the not wanting to be the first person to stop clapping sort
yes,
of thing
yes.
in that sort of...
Yes, and it's it's actually pretty tragic, a terrible, cruel thing that this was for political reasons. That's the only indicator for why you should have that instead of anything else. Was for political reasons. And I think there's a historian, Paul Unschultz, who's the major historian of Chinese medicine, and he says it was a terrible thing, and it's very welcome that it's now fallen into whatever.
Let's move on to a couple of other treatments, which are ones that often, I think, strike people as unusual to be described as, you know, in the alternative medicine and sort of quackery bracket, and that's chiropractors and osteopaths, who are quite similar techniques. But what's interesting here is you talk about basically these were invented not that long ago by I'll let you take up the story.
Well, by a couple of what the Americans call storefront hucksters. Chiropractic was invented by somebody called Daniel David Palmer, and he tried all sorts of things to make a buck, basically. And he'd been a grocer and a fishmonger, and he tried. He was very into magnetic healing for a while, and I would imagine he must have heard about osteopathy and saw that it was a good opportunity. But I've seen no evidence of that. But it's too much of a coincidence because it happened so near to the invention of osteopathy. And yes, and he started doing that and making a lot of money out of it. And even more interestingly, had a terrible dispute with his son, who at one point Daniel Palmer was in prison for, I think, acting illegally or something in some way, or saying he was a doctor when he wasn't. And his son staged a coup and took over everything. And after that, they were always at loggerheads. And the son realised that, in fact, the big money in chiropractic was to be made in training chiropractors rather than just setting up in practice on your own. And he became a multimillionaire by doing that.
So let's talk about what chiropractic is based on, the idea of... You know, the subluxation.
Well, yes, what they believe is that, or what Palmer believed, and I don't know, it's hard to pin them down, the modern ones, what they actually believe, but what Palmer believed was that 99% of illness was caused by irregularities in the spine that he called subluxations that interfered with the nervous energy coming from the spine to the bits of the body. So, if you could, for instance, he thought that, or said, his first chiropractic adjustment was on his janitor, and he said he cured him of deafness by by racking a bone in his spine. And then he said he'd cured somebody of a heart condition by racking another bone. And it sort of took off from there. But the idea is that there is this thing called a subluxation, which does exist in orthodox medicine, and it means a kind of dislocation. And it's a real thing, and it can happen to real joints. But the chiropractic subluxation is really a kind of mythic thing because you can't identify it. They do a lot of x-raying, which is a whole other story, which I think is a danger, and I don't think they should do it so much because what they're looking for is something that doesn't exist. And they say that their treatment will put it right, and also, as so many alternative practitioners say, you have to keep on having treatment to maintain your balance or maintain your energies or whatever it is.
There's something interesting you just raised there, actually, because until I've just read your book, I wasn't aware of the extent to which having an X-ray does expose you to a high, slightly higher risk of developing cancer, for instance. So clearly, unnecessary X-rays
With chiropractic, that it is a small danger, but having an X-ray for no reason at all. I mean, I remember when I was a very small child, we used to be able to measure our feet at the clerk's shop, looking at the X-ray, and you know, I loved that. It was just fantastic, fabulously interesting. But clearly, it's not worth doing just to put on a pair of shoes. It's equally not worth doing when it's in pursuit of non-existent subluxations. But with chiropractic, that I feel that is a danger, and it's worth pointing it out. But the most dangerous aspect of it is the manipulations they do of the neck, which have been known to result in tearing of the vertebral arteries and stroke and even death and paralysis and death after that. And it's very rare, but again, it's not worth the risk if there isn't the benefit.
So osteopathy then, what's the difference?
Well, it's different insofar as they use different movements. They don't have that idea of the subluxation within it. It was invented by somebody who was quite similar to Palmer insofar as he thought he was inventing it was a cure for all diseases, he thought, which again, modern osteopaths I don't think would claim. And he also saw it as a kind of religious thing. Palmer, the chiropractic man, actually thought he was founding a religion. He saw himself, he wrote about seeing himself like a religious leader, like Jesus, or Mary Baker Eddy, you know, who started Christian Science, that sort of thing. That's what he thought he was doing alongside the treatments.
Okay, well, one of the things, I mean, you just mentioned the idea about the possibility of stroke and that we didn't talk about when we talked about the Chinese herbal medicine.
Yes.
We should have talked about perhaps some of the,
you
know, a reason for given for the tolerance of most alternative medicines is that, you know, as long as you're not taking them as an alternative to, I don't know, chemotherapy or something, which we'll get onto, they're mostly harmless. But as you've just demonstrated with the chiropractic, there is you know, a small danger. And again, with Chinese herbal medicine, interestingly, there's even more so.
Yes, I think it's pretty shocking when you look more closely at it, insofar as there are some. I mean, when you have a Chinese herbal mixture, you basically don't know what you've been given. There's no way of telling. And when people actually look at this stuff and examine what's in it, very frequently it's found that it's either adulterated with things which happen in the manufacture, like lead or mercury or something like that, or equally problematic is that it can frequently be adulterated with prescription pharmaceuticals like steroids, Viagra, that kind of thing. And it's not in every herbal medicine, but the trouble is there's no way of telling which ones it's in. And the people who prescribe it, you know, when I've said this, I've written about this, and they've got very angry about it, accusing them of having this. But I think they should put their own house in order and check out exactly what's going on with the high street herbalist. Because certainly when any research is done, recently there was some research, I think, on Ayurvedic medicines in the States, and 20% of them had lead and mercury in them, and it's just not on, and they call it a food supplement.
Okay, let's move on to I just mentioned the idea of replacing something like chemotherapy with a different regime of an alternative medicine. Let's talk about some of the ways in which cancer and the treatment of cancer is sometimes hindered and affected by the prevalence of alternative medicine. And particularly, I want to talk about the idea of the sort of suppression of the cure, basically. That there are groups out there that are claiming that there is a cure for cancer out there,
yes,
and it's being suppressed.
Yes.
And this idea, again, a trope that comes up, it's another one of your red flags, the idea that a person's got a natural cure.
Between the pharmaceutical industry and the medical profession, who don't want there to be a cure for cancer because it would do them out of a job, basically, is how it's seen. And
which, interestingly, as you do mention, doesn't really seem to happen with most other diseases that have famously been cured.
That's right. Yes. So they talk about the cancer industry as a sort of strange thing. I think they almost think that it gives you cancer and then it doesn't cure it, and it's just a vicious circle of cancer. And it's a real problem, and because cancer patients use alternative medicine more than anybody else, in fact. And in fact, it varies between types of cancer. People with breast cancer are the greatest users, or people with brain tumours don't tend to use it for some reason. And it's a real problem because they talk about it being complementary sometimes and supporting orthodox treatment. But when you look at the kinds of things they're saying about what they're doing, the actual language, to me, indicates that they're telling you that if you use this, you've got a better chance of survival. And that's just simply not true. And they haven't got the evidence to back that up. And I think, so it's taking advantage of people when they're at their most needy and desperate, who, when, if you are facing, say, a course of chemotherapy, and somebody says, well, wait, you don't need to do this immediately. I'll give you these little flower heads to look at, and that will do it. Clearly, that's far more appealing, and it's what you'd want. It would be great. It would be a marvellous option if it worked, but it doesn't. And any delay may make your cancer more difficult to treat.
I suppose you just touched on it a little bit there in that sort of answer, but let's look at a little bit about what is the attraction, why, I suppose also who is most likely to be attracted to alternative medicine, and what is the, what's the attraction of it? Be above and beyond, I suppose, the fact that it has health claims.
It's the easy thing to say is that it gives, and it, well, it's true, it gives people a lot of attention. It gives, you can buy 3/4 of an hour of somebody listening to everything you want to say to them. They tell you that everything about your life is worth relating and talking about, and that is a very positive thing for some people. And they also, I think some people feel it empowers them in some sort of way to make themselves more healthy and live better and have more control over their lives in a way that they don't feel they get from their GP at all with a 10-minute consultation. So that's I wouldn't knock that, because, well, I do knock it if it's on false pretenses, but clearly it's fulfilling a need.
That's a good point, though. I mean, you just mentioned there, the 10-minute consultation, but then you actually talk about, the average time a person will spend talking to a GP is something crazy like 28 seconds or something.
Before they interrupt you, yeah. And so you buy this, and it's also an unconditional thing, because in a funny sort of way, I suppose the power that it gives to the patient or the client in that exchange, the alternative practitioner never says, just go home, lie down, take a pill, go away. They always want, because they want you back, they want you to keep coming. And so they may well flatter you and tell you how special and different and important you are, and wise and clever for doing the treatment or whatever it is that they're offering.
I've sort of written down here that alternative medicine is a secular religion. I mean, it's a faith-based thing as well, isn't it? And it's interesting you sort of talk about the way that a lot of the stuff, be it sort of these ideas of an energy, of a life force,
yes,
so have something of the sort of
nearly,
supernatural.
Yes, nearly all alternative things have either something like be the vis vitalis or innate intelligence or something like that, that's some kind of energy very similar to a religious idea. And I think that's also why I've certainly found why people get so angry when it's questioned. It is like questioning somebody's religion if you say, what's the evidence for your claims? And people really feel personally attacked by somebody like me saying, actually, there's no evidence, or actually, homeopathic remedies are sugar pills and water. You know, that is a really they find it both shocking and offensive for it to be questioned or those suggestions to be made.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're actually, as usual, we've quickly run out of time. We've still loads to discuss. So, Rose, thanks very much for joining
Pleasure.
Us today. I'm